Welcome to Trends in Academic Publishing, brought to you by Dainta, the publishing solutions company. In this episode, I'm going to be finding out about an independent academic publisher that from the outside may seem like a bit of an enigma. It's a business which has rejected some of the main measures that others in the industry have adopted to stay competitive, most notably offshoring and outsourcing. And for as long as I've known them as a client, they have deliberately retained an in-house team to manage the whole production process themselves. Many of the publishers I talk to would regard this as unaffordable, but for this company, this model seems to be working.
We're investing in new lists, we're recruiting people.
And has helped them keep the personal touch.
We try to be the most author-friendly publisher, offering a really high-quality service and thereby getting author loyalty, getting repeat authors, and getting recommendation as well.
The name of the company is Edward Elgar Publishing, and they specialize in books on law, business, and social sciences. They're innovative and they're profitable. How do they do it? Well, their MD, Tim Williams, will reveal all.
We see technology as the way to keep things in-house, to potentially leapfrog those big publishers that are outsourcing everything and offshoring everything.
The first time I met Tim, it was clear that he was looking for innovation and ways to make both his own team, but also his authors, happier in what they do and the business overall to be more productive. A latecomer to the publishing world, but a really impressive character, bringing experience from other sectors of the corporate world. So how did he end up as MD of Edward Elgar?
Well, as you know, Patrick, Elgar's a family business founded by Edward and Sandy Elgar back in 1986, really with a vision of being a preeminent academic publisher in the social sciences. And to answer your question, I'm actually related to Edward and Sandy Elgar through my wife, Catherine Elgar, who also works at the business. And I run the business with my brother-in-law, Alex, as well. And both Alex and I had careers before and joined the business through the family. And that's how we came to work here.
Okay, so tell me about the businesses that you're in before and the type of work you were doing before.
So I worked in retail marketing, business development, and consumer marketing as well was my first career. And from there, moved into management consultancies and had some experience in a variety of businesses through that. And then actually briefly joined a large blue chip scholarly publisher for a brief period before joining Elgar.
Okay, so that's interesting. How do those industries compared to publishing? I have also come into publishing from other sectors and I have got a few views about how it differs, most of which are very positive. I wondered, what was your experience?
I think first and foremost, publishing's a really nice industry to work in. In retail, for instance, you would never have gone out and talked to your competitors. You would treat them as your sort of sworn enemies almost. Whereas in publishing, people are quite happy to have a coffee with you and tell you about their business and the challenges and how we can improve as a whole as well. And I sometimes reflect on that. I guess it's partly because we, people in academic publishing at least, we sort of feel like there's a bit of a higher mission and we're providing a service to the academic community and to scholarship. And generally people come into academic publishing because they want to be part of that. And that sort of really feeds through to the ethos of many firms as well.
How did you find Edward Elgar when you first turned up?
I think book publishing anyway, back when I joined some 16 years ago, was an academic publishing, was a very different position to where it is now. As you'll know, Patrick, I mean, journal publishing was on the technology forefront and I think books had been sort of slightly left behind. And that was the same across all academic publishers. But it was clear the way the industry was moving was towards more digital content. And that's also, that's transpired really. But it wasn't necessarily totally clear how we were going to get from where we were. I mean, actually largely selling print books, and the print book market was one where you didn't really know who your customers were. You sold through booksellers around the world and pretty much price at sort of one book, one price worldwide. I mean, there obviously were discounts in developing markets, but it was a pretty sort of rigid sort of sales models around that. And moving to where we are today, where, you know, we're probably sort of over 70% now digital sales compared with back then we were. I guess 95% print sales.
And what kind of resources do you have internally?
So we're just over 100 people. I guess where we might differ for many is that we have a fairly large team in-house producing books as well as commissioning them and distributing and selling. So we project manage our production of our books in-house. And I guess that's part of our original founding ethos, is that we would try and be a preeminent publisher in the fields that we publish by offering a really high quality service to authors, and thereby getting author loyalty, getting repeat authors, and getting recommendation as well, which is something we're trying to track. We have a net author recommender score where we ask authors how likely they are to recommend Elgar to their professional colleagues once they've published their book. And so we've got a great team, a really nice loyal team as well. So it's not unusual for people to be celebrating their 30th anniversary with us. And you've met many of those people as well, Patrick. And as we've developed the business, we've tried to do that with the guys we've got and give them responsibility. And it's great to see people running with projects.
Our trends report identified, I think 61% of publishers said that their number one concern strategically was economic sustainability.
Yeah.
Would that be something you recognise? And can I ask broadly, what's the health of Edward Elgar financially?
Yeah, well, one of our founding principles, which we're careful to follow, is not to bet the farm, as it were. We're in a solid financial position. We're owning our offices, and we have no bank debt. And that was one of the rules that Edward laid down when Alex and I took over the business. And so, for instance, during the pandemic, we didn't feel the need to cut production as many publishers did. We ploughed on because we had the stability to be able to do that. And I think that's really important. And again, it comes back to, you know, we're trying to think the long term and trying to ensure that we're in a position to weather financial storms and uncertainty in the future.
Yeah. I suppose not having a bank debt is an admirable position to try and be in, but it's very hard to achieve. And you've managed to stay out of that hole for the duration, have you?
Yes, certainly during my time here for the last 15, 16 years, I think that decision came a bit from Edward, our founder's sort of experience, both having had debt in the past with banks for businesses and also at previous places where he worked, where they were having to sort of manage cash flow and be in a situation where they didn't have enough money to pay author royalties or suppliers. And it was obviously a formative, painful experience. And he was absolutely adamant that as soon as he possibly could, he would run a business with that financial security and just focus on publishing good books. And I mean, obviously, we're in a commercial environment and there are ups and downs, but we run the business in a really conservative way and just try and think for the long term.
So just on that, we are going through a geopolitical storm at the moment. And my understanding is that you've got a strong US base. A lot of your sales come from overseas. How vulnerable are you to other markets and places like the States with the situation around the moment?
Yeah, very vulnerable. I mean, we actually see being geographically diversified as a strength. And certainly we aim to publish books that we think have got a global market. And certainly through previous downturns, that has been a strength.
Yeah. I wonder if we just move on to independence and being an independent publisher. Mm. And not trying to dwell on finances, but I presume you'll see independence for Edward Elgar, something more than just where the profits land. What does it mean to you to be an independent publisher?
You have to sort of stand on your own two legs. You can't be reliant on funding from a larger university with hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to back you up if you get into trouble. So we do feel that we have to think ahead and we have to think for the long term. Partly it's about that connection with the author as well. So, you know, I think many of our authors like to publish with an independent rather than a large commercial press where maybe you've got one person you speak to when you approach them with a book idea, then a second who commissions it, and a third by the time you've written it and delivered it, and a fourth by the time it's come out of production. And so we certainly aspire to have a long-term relationship with authors and hopefully they come back then time and time again.
Edward Elgar are unusual in that they are of a size and such a successful business that they haven't yet been poached by a larger commercial publisher, which is definitely the way that this industry is going and has gone in the last 5 years. So I've spoken to senior people at big commercial publishers who have told us they have significant budgets to go out and make acquisitions of other successful publishers. So they would certainly have their eye on publishers like Edward Elgar. I presume you've been approached. Is there a policy towards being acquired?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it doesn't happen so much. They've kind of given up. So the decisions that we're making as a business are not the decisions you would make if you were thinking of selling. We're investing for the long term. We're investing in new lists. We're recruiting people at a junior level to train them up and to build the business organically over the next 10, 20 years. And that's our strategy. It's worked, and we think we've got a long way to go with that.
Yeah, and obviously the subjects that you've chosen, social sciences, business, and law, they're very commercially successful.
Yeah.
I've heard some other publishers, well, won't name, bemoaning the fact that they stepped into an organization that specializes in what's commonly terms of dead subjects, subjects which have a much kind of smaller market,
sure,
and therefore are harder to make a profit from. Mm. I presume you are strategically, you've decided to kind of specialize on those subjects for that reason.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, I think we started out in sort of social sciences, and that's where we've built a reputation, and it's difficult to move quickly into new subject areas unless you acquire lists. And we've always taken the view that it's kind of difficult to outbid some of the big corporates when looking at acquiring a list. But essentially, I think any subject area can work, because in publishing, in academic publishing, it's really the niches that matter. And if you're a sort of famous in a small niche, it doesn't matter what that niche is. There are synergies and economies of scale that are generated from having authors that also read your books and look out for your books, and therefore will submit their books, because there's a lot of cost around commissioning if you're not a top three publisher in a field, and similarly in selling and marketing books as well, if readers aren't and libraries aren't looking out for your titles. So being strong in niches, I think, is key rather than the niche itself. And I think obviously some of those so-called dead subjects, you're probably talking about more like the sort of humanities type subjects, which often can have much lower production costs as well. So I think there are economic models that work in different areas. Some of the social science areas, we find they're relatively higher production costs once you start having figures, tables, equations, and some of the technical aspects of the content, which you'll be well aware of, Patrick, yeah, with your product line. There's some complexities, really, of making some of that content accessible and discoverable.
Yeah, I remember speaking to a director of a American university press who did very much have a niche, and they were fulfilling their mission, but very proudly telling me that he was perhaps addressing an audience of no more than 25 people across the world that might be interested in some of the titles they were producing.
Right, yeah.
And I found that extraordinary, but at the same time, wonderful that those books would still be created and they're important. But as a commercial publisher, you would probably not decide to do a book like that, I presume.
Yeah, and this is where it comes down to what's the sort of the long-term strategy and where do you want to go? I mean, I think we've been keen to try and diversify the portfolio a bit. And this is my sort of shout out to my brother-in-law, Alex, who drives the strategy on the commissioning side. We've invested in different book types within those subject areas and tried to sort of tap into a bit of professional market as well as academic market as well, whilst, you know, keeping the books at a real quite high end in terms of the intellectual level. And that's part of the reason for investing in technology that helps us have a really slick production process. And I think that's absolutely critical. You know, historically, publishers have tended to offshore to remain competitive, and we've been wary of that. And so we kind of see technology is the way to keep things in-house, to, you know, use technology to potentially leapfrog those big publishers that are sort of outsourcing everything and offshoring everything, whilst retaining a superior service level to authors.
You're listening to Trends in Academic Publishing with me, Patrick Schaaf, and my guest for this episode, Tim Williams, MD of Edward Elgar Publishing. Tim was talking there about how Edward Elgar has managed to avoid outsourcing and to keep commercially viable through the use of technology. And I should declare an interest here in that the company I work for, Dainta, has been helping them with those technical solutions. When we first met Edward Elgar, they were using a well-respected technology that allowed them to tag Word documents and push content into InDesign templates. Our software automates much of that process, pulling content to a cloud-based platform where all stakeholders can access and edit in real time. We call that a single source of truth solution. But managing change of that magnitude is not easy. So I wanted to hear from Tim about how he's approached this and what he's learned. What sort of practical tips could you offer listeners to sort of help them manage their own change programs?
I think it's difficult when you're a a smaller business because you don't have teams of people dedicated to business development sitting around thinking about things. Everybody has a day job. And, you know, we have to free up a bit of resource to dedicate to it, give it more time. I think we're really fortunate. We've got some really great people who are interested in technology, and the team understands the reasons that we're doing it. And having that sort of buy-in and having people who can advocate internally and be champions, I think really helps.
And have you had any outside help with that process? Change management is a tricky business. I'm wondering whether that's been something that you've managed, or there's someone in the internally who likes to kind of champion those kind of projects.
Yeah, we've not had any external change management help. I mean, maybe we should have done. Maybe we were naive. But then I think if you use the people that you've got that understand the business already really well, I think you get to better solutions.
I'm curious, often we talk about some of the sort of cherries on top that you can get once you move to a technology platform. And I'm wondering if that comes into your thinking as well, sort of the opportunities from technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to have a technology framework and platform which we can use then to bring in potentially other services, and whether that is the ability to, you know, automate checking that manuscripts have not been sort of slightly plagiarized or written with generative AI, or those sorts of things. Or there's a lot of technology at the moment we're talking about in AI, which we're clearly, as a publisher, we're somewhat wary about that. But at the same time, it's obviously going to be incredibly beneficial as an assistative technology that can help us mark up the technical aspects of a book manuscript more quickly or more cost effectively, or support our copy editors and our indexers as well. So, you know, there's a lot of benefits coming down the road.
We've seen that there's been quite a defensive attitude towards AI in the industry initially. Do you have a more relaxed view of it?
It depends what you're talking about, right? You know, we could have a whole podcast talking about, we could have a series of podcasts, actually. Patrick, this is probably your next project, a series of podcasts on AI. You know, there's the licensing of AI, and lots of publishers have done that. We haven't at this stage because we're wary of the reaction from authors. And as an independent, we try to be the most author-friendly publisher, and it's easy to destroy that and difficult to build it. So we naturally are a bit more wary of doing things like that. I mean, in terms of how AI can help publishers, I think there's a huge role. And I mentioned some of the technical markup. I think people don't really understand the amount of work that goes into an academic manuscript to make it discoverable, searchable, understandable by a computer reader, etc., or for use by somebody who's partially sighted, for instance. And I think there's some of that sort of technical aspects, I think are absolutely ripe for use with AI. We always expect to have a human in the loop on anything.
Okay.
So things like copy editors, for instance, we always envisage that we would need human copy editors to help authors with their language style, their manuscripts.
Just going back to your comment there about you haven't approached authors yet about licensing of their content. I'm curious, because you've got such a good relationship with your authors. Are you're choosing not to even ask the question, even if it's a no that you get? Are you waiting for that, or is it just that you feel it's best not to ask?
No, I mean, we're more than happy to talk to our authors about these things. I think it's partly that we're not confident maybe enough in the question that we're asking sometimes, because AI is quite a broad set of things. And I think clearly there's huge benefit from some of the more intelligent side of AI, for analyzing and summarizing, for instance. But many of the AI users seem to be actually going out, finding knowledge that's published, and then bringing it back it almost like an advanced search engine. And I think it's very difficult to get sort of clear answers sometimes on exactly how the content is being used and how much it will undermine the author's work or use the author's knowledge that they've spent many years researching and creating without acknowledging them. And certainly acknowledgement and recognition is, I think, something that would be hugely important for scholarly authors.
Are you aware whether any of your content's been used for training LLMs, large language models?
Yeah, it clearly has. Yeah. I mean, and you maybe be aware of the Atlantic article, which allowed people to sort of search for their books and you know, I guess most of our content would have been in there and taken from pirate sites as well. So this is stuff that's been stolen from probably from university libraries or from, I'm not sure where, but essentially hosted in countries where copyright isn't enforceable. So I don't think it'll be a surprise to anybody, really.
How do you see a publisher's role in an age of AI? Not necessarily now, but in a few years' time, and these systems are ubiquitous and sophisticated.
I think the publisher's role doesn't change. It doesn't change from one century to the next. We live and die by the reputation of our imprints, and that helps customers and readers know what is helpful, verified content, and therefore people want to publish with a quality imprint because it also enhances their reputation. So that role of the publisher and the author, I don't see changing. And in fact, it becomes ever more important, frankly, in the world of AI. And there's a reason that AI companies are keen to rip all license. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that it's just being stolen. I mean, lots of AI companies are actually licensing publishers' content as well. But there's a reason why they want published content is because it is verified. It's not libelous. It's authenticated, if you like. Whereas so much of the content now on, whether it's social media or on the internet at large, is just automatically generated. And I believe there's a theory where if you train AI on content that's generated by AI, there's a bit of a spiral into meaningless results.
Yeah. Paper mills and that sort of
Yeah,
process.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so that imminent era, that doesn't keep you awake at night.
So many things keep me awake at night. It probably is one of them, yeah.
But business-wise, what does keep you awake at night? What's the fear?
I think just sort of keeping up with technology. It moves so quickly. And I think you sort of dismiss it and you come up with your worldview and fix that at your peril, really. So I think that we have to have a bit of intellectual flexibility at the moment, honestly. And I, you know, you worry about the state of higher education and whether governments do continue to see it as valuable. What's happening in America, I think, will obviously impact publishers. Things can sort of flip very quickly. So keeping an eye on costs and investing for the future, investing in technology, it's going to be absolutely critical, I think, for the years ahead.
Tim, that's been fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I was really keen to talk to you and to try and understand how it is that you deliver such a successful business but stay independent. And I think you've really answered that question brilliantly. So thanks so much for your time, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick. That's very kind.
So that was Tim Williams, MD of Edward Elgar Publishing. And you've been listening to Trends in Academic Publishing with me, Patrick Schaeff. Tim mentioned an article in The Atlantic magazine about AI. If you weren't aware of that article, there are some details in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, or whichever platform you listen on. And please rate us and review us. It gives us useful feedback and it helps other people discover the podcast. And if you've got a topic or a guest you'd like to hear, please get in touch. And don't feel shy, you can suggest yourself. Just email me at pschaeff@dainta.com. That's Dainta, D-E-A-N-T-A. And finally, if you want to read the annual report of industry trends which inspired this podcast, it's free to download. Like this podcast, it's called Trends in Academic Publishing, and it's available via our website, dainta.com. I've put a link on the show notes. I hope you find that report useful, as well as this podcast. So until next time, thanks for listening.